The think tank faculty next discussed recent trial results with the use of nanoparticle albumin-bound paclitaxel, nab-paclitaxel, and a recent study reported at the last San Antonio and then ASCO meetings by principal investigator Dr. Bill Gradishar. Dr. Holmes began the discussion of this novel agent.
Anytime I can use this instead of paclitaxel, I do. There are significant limitations based on payers. I do think the neuropathy is less, but I think there are patients who have neuropathy problems that we can't predict. And we did a dose dense trial with nab-paclitaxel, and I did see one woman who had significant L5 neuropathy who had loss of function of her lower extremity. It recovered. I've seen reflexes recover with this in a dose dense setting, which I haven't really seen with paclitaxel. So I think it is less toxic. It's certainly easier to give. I've had reactions to it, though, that I couldn't use it as I have with paclitaxel.
Bill, what about this? I was interested with what you reported in terms of neuropathy and the resolution there. How do you put this all together at this point? Do we have enough data to be able to sort of address that question?
No. I mean, that's a simple answer. I think these are observations that are interesting. I think they've been consistent across trials. Part of the problem across trials is how the data is captured, how neuropathy is evaluated. Some of the issue about when you put patients back on or when it resolved is actually subjective rather than some quantitative measure. So I think it's a little bit problematic. But that said, there is sort of this consistent sense across all the experiences, and Joyce can speak to this too, that it does appear to be somewhat different.
What are your thoughts on this, Joyce? And where do you see this heading research-wise? What are the research questions you think will be interesting to look at and are being looked at with this agent?
I think we would benefit from kind of a prospective evaluation of neuropathy because these are just from the CRFs, you know, when you can start it again, et cetera. Just parenthetically, ixabebolone, which has a high degree of neuropathy, is also going to be showing data, you know, when it's published in ODAC and such, that it appears to be a rather rapid rate of resolution down to 0 or 1, whereas with the nab-paclitaxel, it's been improvement, you know, down to less than grade 3. So it may be that there are differences in these agents, but I've always felt we've needed sort of more of a systematic study of the resolution or the improvement, I should say, in the neuropathy. And I don't probably have a real strong clinical sense of that myself, having used a lot of both. I don't have a strong clinical sense one way or the other on that.
In what situations are you using paclitaxel in the metastatic setting?
You know, the metastatic setting is generally such a long that I'm using sort of every drug, it seems like, eventually anyway, because most patients live long enough to get multiple treatments. But I must say I've been leaning a bit more towards the nab-paclitaxel on the weekly schedule. I think I was pretty impressed, actually, with the recent data that Bill showed, you know, comparing it to docetaxel. I was quite impressed with that. And so I've been using more nab. You can get away from the steroids, you know. I always worry a little bit about the glucocorticoid receptors may be, you know, somewhat anti-apoptotic. And I don't know that we know all the clinical consequences at the tumor level with all the dexamethasone we use. So I like to avoid that when I can. So I think it provides very nice palliation. So I do like it in metastatic disease. In terms of how it can make an additional impact, the problem is that the big adjuvant trials that it would be, you have to be looking at numbers of 10,000 or so, and that's probably not the most important question we really want to ask with 10,000 patients, although I do think the data suggests that this may be the most active of the taxanes that we have.
Andy, what about research questions at Memorial, dose dense, AC, NAB, as well as NAB with BEV?
I think given the randomized phase 2 data that Bill presented, there's certainly reasons to believe that the package insert dosing regimen for nanoparticle albumin-bound paclitaxel will probably not remain as the standard. And certainly other experiences with cremaphore-based paclitaxel would argue that Q3-week administration isn't optimal. At Memorial right now, we've decided to build upon the experience from ECOG 2100, and we are randomizing in a multicenter trial patients to receive the package insert dosing regimen or a weekly regimen, which is a 130 per meter squared dose without interruption in the same manner that we administered weekly paclitaxel in CLGB 9840. And a third arm is investigating a dose-dense approach of 260 every 14 days, which is supported by filgrastim. And this trial is a randomized phase 2. It has accrued about 127 patients, and in all arms, patients receive bevacizumab, again, motivated by E2100.
What about, you talked about the pilot trial that you're doing. I mean, is the thought that this eventually, as Joyce said, going to lead into a 10,000-person trial, or where is it heading?
I don't think so. I think, as has been alluded to, there are other very important questions that need to be asked in this population. I think the trial certainly could inform the design of subsequent adjuvant trials if they are ever conducted with this particular taxane. And again, I think we still haven't yet perhaps determined an optimal dosing regimen for this drug in metastatic disease.
I want to ask Lee about the issue about steroids. We just did a patterns of care study where we saw something kind of interesting, which was that about 30% of docs said that they're using corticosteroids when they use NAB. What are your thoughts about it?
I think it speaks to the fact that there's still a lot to be done in disseminating information to the community practitioners, and there's so much information out there about so many therapeutics that it's difficult to cut through and to drill down to the important issues. I think this is an important issue, particularly if we move to a weekly dosing of paclitaxel. If you're using standard paclitaxel, then you're giving steroids every single week, and we're all quite familiar with the problems of that and glucocorticoid-induced diabetes and other complications of that, which really is an issue, I think, for a number of patients. So there's no reason to use pre-medication for nab-paclitaxel. It has practical issues as well in the clinic as compared to even weekly solvent-based paclitaxel in terms of ease of administration, chair time, nurse resource use, and something we don't talk about a lot, which is patient time in the clinic. And we've done a number of surveys on that. And when you really ask patients, although they love their oncologists and their oncology team, they'd rather be anywhere but the clinic. And anything we can do to reduce that time would be appropriate and beneficial to patients.
Melody?
So I just want to agree totally with Skip that it was disappointing to me as I saw the development of this drug. You know, oncologists have this tendency to increase the dose thinking more is better. And George has this wonderful saying, thou shalt not worship at the altar of response. I mean, who cares if the response rate is a little higher? The question is it improving survival? So I would love to see an 80 milligram per meter squared head-to-head comparison of NAB-PAC with paclitaxel. And if they're the same, then NAB wins, hands down. And there would be less overall toxicity from the NAB with a reduced dose. And so probably the same amount of efficacy.
That's a pretty strong statement in terms of, quote, NAB wins, because I found mixed responses, as I think we hear with Harold, about what benefit is of the shorter infusion time, lack of pre-medications. What is it from your point of view clinically?
I've used it when I give dose-dense AC paclitaxel. If the insurance will cover it, I will give NAB instead.
As adjuvant therapy?
Yeah. It's much better tolerated. The patients don't need the steroids, and it's less time in the infusion chair.
Well, I guess we should point out that is not necessarily, I think, a usual practice that people... Anybody else here using adjuvant NAB? Lee?
We almost never get approval for it when we've asked in for specific circumstances.
I'm curious, too, about the corticosteroids, because we're kind of wondering where to go with this thing educationally. We found one paper by Ian Tanick and his group looking at the impact of corticosteroids with pre-medication. They actually found, I think, 75% of these people had significant problems. A lot of that was agitation and insomnia. Frankie, I see you're shaking your head. What do your patients tell you about that? And I wonder, too, whether maybe some of the fatigue that patients have with chemotherapy is related to so much insomnia.
Sure, they come in with a red face and red chest. Although, again, I mostly use the weekly paclitaxel whenever I have an opportunity, and we rapidly taper down. I don't give no steroids. I give them 4 milligrams. So they have the red rash. They have the fatigue. We have those patients that have that precipitous decadron withdrawal. Suddenly, you know, they're clean in the closet. They can't sleep. And then suddenly they're a slug, and they can't do anything. And that makes them depressed. Plus, as we all know, our adjuvant patients gain weight. They don't have the energy to go out and exercise. They eat the same amount. They get acne reactivation, so we're giving them the clindamycin. I think the steroids detract from the quality of life.
George?
So let's do sort of a Duncan experiment and go back to 1992 and say if it was 1992 and you were Bristol-Myers Squibb and you had the opportunity to develop paclitaxel or nab-paclitaxel, which one would you develop? And, you know, I think just to state that, the answer is pretty obvious. Why would you not want to get rid of steroids? So I think from that simple issue of tweaking things, the minor advance, and it is a minor advance, but a real advance, the minor advance of getting rid of steroids, why would you not want to get rid of steroids? But I think a real question actually raised by Bill's data is, are there settings where this is not just a minor advance, but a real advance in terms of improving efficacy of the therapy. Now, the problem is we don't have those trials available to us, or at least not sufficiently powered trials, to tell us whether or not this might be a real advance in some settings, either in the metastatic setting or an adjuvant setting. I actually would like to see those well-powered trials. That would give me that answer. Economics is a reality of our lives, and paying 10 times as much to get rid of steroids, you know, is arguably not a good use of society's dollars. But if we saw a real improvement in survival, either in the adjuvant or the metastatic setting, that would be a real benefit and a real positive use of those dollars.
Dennis, this also raises the issue of how much data do you need to make a change in your therapy in the adjuvant situation where we're going for cure? Are we going to need a large phase 3 randomized study to look at nab-paclitaxel, or could we use something short of that? Any thoughts on that?
Well, the only thought is, I think what's been raised earlier in terms of just the design of the trials overall, if you're using sort of one-size-fits-all approaches, you need large trials. But if you can subcategorize patients, and with taxane use, there are markers that may be tracking with efficacy, you might be able to get a signal out of smaller trials, and that would be a very useful thing to do.
I just want to go back to Skip. I'm curious what your thoughts are, both from a clinical, practical point of view today, in terms of, you know, where it fits in, and to what extent, if any, are you excited about its future?
Well, I mean, to get an adjuvant trial that had, you know, a meaningful comparison to it would certainly be attractive to moving the drug forward. Their economic issues are real. There's been some correspondence here on the computer about the fact you get into that circle of getting it approved, the difference in the copay for the patient, you know, all the issues that go into it. So it makes it a complicated decision. It's one of those drugs right now where economics weighs into the clinical decision, and that isn't true for many of our therapies right now, which is nice. So I think our group, head-to-head, I think we would agree with everything that was said here. I mean, if you had everything was the same, the two drugs side by side, you'd give nab-paclitaxel every time.
I wonder if the patients are aware that these kinds of debates are going on and that economics are being considered as these decisions are being made.
We've actually had a major private insurer come to us and ask us if we'd consider a taxane to, you know, on a recontracting thing. As private insurers look at ASP models versus AWP, you know, is there data to suggest that we as a major insurance company couldn't just say docetaxel, paclitaxel, nab-paclitaxel, they're all the same? You guys pick the doses if you think that's the issue, but we're going to reimburse them. Much like we went through with prostate drugs, you know, with the Lupron and Zoladex story. So that kind of thinking's out there, and we fought back against that, but that kind of thinking's out there.
We're in the midst of a profound change in the delivery of cancer care in the United States that was triggered by the Medicare Modernization Act 2003 and is now gaining momentum as that act continues to change and some of the reimbursement rewards, if you will, that were given for the first few years have disappeared. So not only are reimbursements now for many drugs actually underwater, in other words, at ASP plus six, although the calculation is that there's a margin to the private practitioner, that's really not true when you factor in all the costs of storage and not paying and copays and so forth. But in fact, as Skip alluded to, the private payers now are looking at new models as well, some of whom are looking at ASP models and others are being a little bit more creative in terms of trying to define cost effectiveness, which hopefully is the way that we'll go. So I think that increasingly, from our perspective, behind the scenes, absolutely, reimbursement comes into play, and picking drugs is very much dependent on that. And now, I think because of a tremendous media assault, I'm not sure what has prompted it on oncologists by certain of large media outlets in this country, there is a wedge being driven for patients against their physicians, which I'm very concerned about. And I've had for the first time patients coming to me and asking, even in my part of the country where it's not the most medically sophisticated portion of the country, it's certainly not Boston or the Upper East Side of Manhattan, patients saying, are you giving me erythropoietin to make money? Why are you giving me this drug? And we haven't heard it yet about the nab-paclitaxel versus generic paclitaxel yet, but I think it will come given this unprecedented onslaught.